Hello and welcome to You Don't Know Lit. My name is Nick Argyris, and this week I'm looking for the best dystopian short story.
Short dystopian story.
Short for short.
I just want to share something that happened to me this week. I was writing comments on student work, and I wanted to say right out the word thanks for sharing, but accidentally I put a T after the R.
Thanks for sharding. Yeah. Wow. Do you think students still know what sharts are, or do you think that was like...
Oh, absolutely they do. Okay. That was not a nice thing to write about someone's poem that they had written about like personal trauma.
Sharts are timeless, Joe. Mm,
okay. Yeah, everyone.
Everyone's sharts. Haven't you read the famous book?
Everybody's sharts. Do you think the order of adjectives matters when you say dystopian short stories? Like, can you say short dystopian stories?
Oh, that's okay. To help me are two short high school English teachers, Ian and Joe.
Well, first of all, I am not short. I am very normally heighted, probably above average, if anything. And Ian, I have met in real life. He is quite tall. He's a tall, tall boy. Yep. I am a normally heighted high school English teacher. My name is Joseph Harvey Holshue. And if you are looking for a short dystopian story, I brought Lit Head Recommendation Karen's The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster. Famous author, pretty famous short story. And yeah, I'm excited to talk about it.
Good morning, Lit Heads. Good afternoon, Joe. And nothing to you, Nick.
Sounds good.
Yep, we're starting off with hostility. I'm choosing violence.
That's my favorite.
This morning, my name is Dr. Ian DeYoung. I'm a hostile high school English teacher. I'm also very short on patience, and I'm just going to be really snappish today. So get ready for that.
I get the connection.
This week, I did not bring a Lit Head recommendation. I brought an Ian Head recommendation. Mm-hmm. This is Ursula K. Le Guin's short... philosophical narrative / short story, The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas.
May your earlobes turn into assholes and shit on your shoulders.
Hey, the plot doesn't fucking matter at all. This is what I think it's about.
If you look closely enough, every author was at some point a racist.
Audiobooks don't count, right?
All art is quite useless.
Who told you that?
Fun fact, that is how Joe laughs.
Ursula K. Le Guin, frequent on the show, beloved by all of us here. Yep. She's got to work on naming her stories, I think.
Why?
I think she...
Why?
They're hard to remember. The Ones Who Walk Away from Amabob? What is it?
Nope.
Amabob. Oh,
so this is... Okay, guys,
Amababa Dig Dog.
How offensive are we being right now when we say Amabob?
I'm going to talk directly to the Lit Heads. Every now and again, the show takes a clear direction within the first 30, 90 seconds. This is going to be one of those shows where Nick and Joe don't listen to anything I say and just mock one of the words in the title of my story. This happened with A Canticle for Leibovitz years ago, and I have not forgotten it because that's one of my favorite books of all time. And these chumps. Hey,
titles matter,
so,
guys.
If that kind of episode is not for you, Lit Heads, I just want to tell you to just tune out right now.
You know what a punchy title is? The Machine Stops. You know what happens. It's right there in the title. I know what a machine is. There's drama. It stops. I'm waiting for it to stop.
Is that about a train, Joe? Is your book about a train?
Hey, we'll get into it. It's about the machine.
Yeah, it's about the machine.
Wow.
This week was a light reading week for both of us, and I thought it would be really good film. If both of us, each short of books. Us read the other person's story. And that did not happen for me.
I'm very happy it didn't happen for you because you did not share that plan with me. So I definitely did not read your story.
And Lit Heads, I have also done very, very little research in preparing for an hour of your time, Lit Heads.
I think this is probably the most important hour of the week for us. Mm-hmm. Certainly for our bank accounts and possibly for, you know, global peace.
Global peace. Welcome, Lit Heads, to You Don't Know Lit, a weekly, or as we call it, strongly podcast, where every week, Lit Heads share with us themes and recommendations and books, and Joe and Ian bring two book recommendations to present, and Joe and Ian present two book recommendations.
This is just improvising his way through the spiel.
Yeah, sometimes it's good to just get your elbows out and, you know, feel like you're in a safe space. I know you mentioned hostility, but, you know.
I just want you to know this is not safe for you.
one of you may lose. It's getting closer and closer to Ian. Gentlemen, some rules. Rule number one, only unavoidable spoilers. Please don't spoil it. Please don't read the book either.
Yeah, which is generally not a risk, but with short episodes like this, with episodes about shorts, yeah, you bet.
People are thinking, is the episode going to be shorter because the books are so short? And the answer is absolutely not.
Never.
This is going to be a full length.
Like 4 hours.
Maximum. Joe stories. Rule number, I don't know which one we're on. Rule number three. Oh, yep. So.
Omitney.
You guys gotta win. Tell me what your book is about.
Allow me to describe for you a hellish dystopia. You live your day in a room, every convenience in the world available to you at the push of a button or flip of a switch. Work has long since been made obsolete. You spend your time encountering ideas, attending online lectures, researching interests, and presenting those interests to the wider world. You speak into your on-screen like monitor, your connection to the corpus of all of human knowledge. Also, the surface of the earth is a desolate wasteland. The vast majority of your life takes place underground. But that stuff, right, isn't as important. This novelette predates George Orwell, predates Aldous Huxley, and is contemporary with H.G. Wells. I brought The Machine Stops by E.M. Forster.
When you say novelette, which I love, and the only thing thing I heard from what you said, Ian, tell us what your book is about.
Imagine a world where everything is perfect. That's it. Nothing is wrong. There's happiness, widespread peace. It's like somehow always sunny, but not in Philadelphia, in the city of Omelas. But there's one problem. In order for this place to exist, to function, one person has to bear all of the civilization's sadness, guilt, misery, pain, etc.
That's great.
In this story that I brought this week, Ursula Le Guin asks what price we're willing to pay for utopia. And I have some questions for you guys.
Oh, are they about the price we are willing to pay for utopia? Is this like trolley problem, the episode? Yeah.
Yes, it is. My book is 5 pages long.
Wow.
There is not much to talk about in terms of plot, but I think back to there is an author who wrote a play called Doubt, and the play Doubt is like half the length of a normal play. It's not supposed to be not supposed to run the full, so like you're supposed to get to the intermission and then that's it, that's the end of the play. And he said like the second act of the play is people going home and debating what happens at the end, which is a very, very much a playwright thing to say.
Sounds very pretentious. Yes, 100%.
I kind of feel like
it's going to take place in your mind.
Okay. Like much of this podcast does, Leadheads. It's going to take place in your mind.
I say we just end this right now and the rest of the podcast can take place in the Leadhead's mind.
I love that.
It's a lot easier for us.
Now that's a cop out. Ian, why don't you go first and then we can really drag it through the mud the rest of the episode?
Oh, that sounds like absolute heaven.
All right, what's the name of your book again so we can make fun of that immediately and get sidetracked?
The Ones Who Walk Away from Omelas.
Omelas. What's Omelas?
Well, this is the town. The town / it's a city state. It's both a city and a whole. Like,
okay, we don't need to get into coding.
Civilization. She got the name. Le Guin got the name when she was driving in Oregon, and she drove past a road sign that said Salem, Oregon. And she said, huh. That collection of letters would look interesting backwards.
Love it.
And she put them backwards and...
But she put an O on it.
O for Oregon. Yep.
Hey, love it. Good.
Yeah, so...
So creative.
I also didn't think that... As much as we love The Wizard of Earthsea here, I feel like Earthsea's a pretty stupid name for a place.
It's a very 1968. Mm-hmm. Like, there are not very many dated things about that book, but yes. This book is the story is quite simple. I keep calling it a book. The story is quite simple. So in the story, it starts off, right? Everything is beautiful. Everything is perfect. These people like don't need anything, any of the traditional utopian distractions. So she's like, yeah, there's a drug, but people don't really use it.
Oh, okay.
There's like kind of free love, but you know what? People don't need that. That's not like, that's not the thing that keeps us going.
Just like Oregon.
There isn't like a dominant government or a perfect government.
Just like Oregon.
There's not a religious organization that like ensures that everyone can be happy or everyone needs this. There's not a thing, she says, that makes this socially effective. It's just that there is one child in a broom closet who is treated badly.
Okay.
Yes. You have some questions. Go ahead, Nick.
Yeah. Okay. Yes. How is he treated badly? Yeah. Is he just neglected? Is he actively messed with? Like, is he hit with a hose? Is he starved? Do people poke him? Et cetera.
He is isolated.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, the child is not able to like have positive interactions with people. People come to look at him. Mm-hmm. The citizens who are happy come to look at him.
This is like a zoo.
They know he's there.
Yep. And they know that he is like, he bears their sins. It's like, he's a scapegoat.
They know that too. And when they go, they cannot give him any kind treatment. If they were to give him any kind treatment, then the whole system would break down and magically they would lose everything that they have.
So, okay. So says who? Does the book answer that? It's a short stories don't really answer the logical questions.
It doesn't get into the sort of the logic of this, the system. Is this kind of like,
you just have to blindly accept that that's the premise of the short, right?
Right? Like, yeah, take as given that this is the situation.
Got it. Okay.
And people have compared this to Shirley Jackson's The Lottery, where they have the ritual just to kill people. Like, one person is chosen randomly, and that is supposed to keep the society going. One of the things about The Lottery, though, is that that's a book where it's not clear if the lottery actually has this effect. And in Omelas, yes, definitely this scapegoat kid, because he is starved, because he is kept in the dark, because he is not cleaned, that keeps this society running perfectly.
Yeah, utopia.
Optimally.
Did this come out before or after The Purge?
I'm also wondering before or after The Giver.
Okay.
Ooh, I think it came out before The Giver.
I think The Giver is like in the 90s or something.
What's The Giver?
We should bring that to the podcast sometime.
Yeah, The Giver is it's a short book, right? A short book that has a kind of similar premise where like one person isn't necessarily mistreated, but one person is responsible for all of like the knowledge and the pain of humanity, if I remember this. And like they take on the burdens of society.
Yes. But the difference,
it's more of like an honorary position, if I remember.
Yeah. Oh, okay.
This is 20 years before The Giver.
It is strange that they're not grateful to this kid. Ian, does he deserve it? Is he a naughty little boy? Did he draw on the sofas?
Has he sinned?
He drew on the carpet. He drew on the walls. I just want to come back to The Giver. Well, I'll come back to The Giver in a bit. This kid did not, like, this is not because he was the worst kid. It is sort of implied that he's just sort of randomly chosen because somebody has to do it.
Is he an orphan?
Like the Dalai Lama.
Does he have parents? Potentially. You can't answer any of these questions, can't you? It's a short, it's 5 pages, you said.
Yeah, but they can't. Like, and I think it doesn't really, not to deny your question, but I don't think it really matters to the story whether he is.
Let's just jump ahead.
Not. Yes.
The whole point of the story is it worth it, right? Should one person suffer for everybody to live in perfect harmony? Is that the big question? Go home and discuss.
I would say there are two big questions here. So one big question is that one, Nick, and I want to talk to you guys about that. I want to hear what you have to say. The other question is, what do you do with this?
What do I do with what?
Like, let's say you're in Omelas.
Yeah.
Let's say you're there. Mm-hmm. So lots of people participate. We can start there and we can move to the, is it worth it? Lots of people live there and participate and they're good. They like it. And
all the people benefiting really like it.
Yeah. And they're fine with it. But there are some who leave, hence the title, the ones who walk away from Omelas.
Yeah, no thank you, they say. No thank you. This isn't for me.
Oma later. Sorry.
I'm out of here.
What's the other big question?
That's the other big question. What do you do?
Oh, what do you leave?
Like this evil exists. You know it exists. Like mm-hmm. you are a full participant in this. You are a direct beneficiary of it.
Right.
Are you cool with that?
So actually,
Joe, would you vacation here?
Let's start with, because something Joe just said made me think, maybe we should start with what would you like, is this worth it? Because I think, Joe, you said, you know, this evil exists. I think if you don't think of it as an evil, you're going to stay. So
yeah.
May I put this forward?
Yes.
I think the option of leaving is the only thing that makes this book work, because it's already happening whether you're there or not. So why wouldn't you stay? Right? That's the argument.
So you're saying,
or you could leave. You could leave and walk away from, you know, heaven on earth, but it's right. still happening.
Go live in the woods.
So why wouldn't you take advantage of the effect?
But it's still happening. It's not happening for you. You're not morally complicit. You're not like you're not like living off the fat of the land.
But you're not stopping it though.
Yeah. Right. So this is the third option. So this story has sparked a lot of kind of responses. And if we have time, I'll read a couple of 1-star reviews, which are amazing.
I will be reading all 1-star reviews on this podcast. Thank you very much.
Okay, please, Nick, please.
Here's one from Estevan.
Please read the ones that Ian sends to you.
What I've learned from this book is that the author is crazy insane with utopia, and she will die dreaming if it is so boring. I am sorry to say I got bored fast and freaked out. That's from Estevan. I think he speaks multiple languages.
The first one on my list. I love that one so much. Crazy insane with utopia.
Mediocre version of Ivan's speech in The Brothers Karamazov.
What's Karamazov? Ivan's speech? Nobody knows how to pronounce that.
So this is another piece of this book, which is she's not the first to propose this. She's not the first to say, you know, would a society predicated on the suffering, would happiness predicated on the suffering of one person be a just society? So
is this about Jesus, Ian?
Well, a Russian author named Dostoevsky first puts it forward and says, like, in terms of Jesus takes on the guilt, the sin of everyone. And like Christianity says, we're not just cool with that. We're not just like, oh yeah, whatever. No, Christianity says that is amazing. That is
perfect. Amazing. Like, we love that.
That is beautiful. That is like the thing that we love. Mm-hmm. So, I'm not familiar with the Dostoevsky piece, but like this could be read as a critique of Christianity that says, okay, your system is predicated on one person suffering so that the whole world is perfect or can be perfect. Are you okay with that? There was a really boring, dreadful English philosopher author named William James, who I despise, who puts forward names. This similarly. And Le Guin was not aware of James when she wrote the story. So after she wrote it, everyone was like, so you're doing a William James thing? And she's like, no, I thought I was doing a Dostoevsky thing. But
it's really
James
annoying.
Says, I'm going to read what James says. He says, if the hypothesis were offered of a world in which every utopia that's been written could be outdone and millions kept permanently happy on the one simple condition that a certain lost soul on the far off edge of things should lead a life of lonely torture, what, except a skeptical and independent sort of emotion, can it be which would make us immediately feel, even though an impulse arose within us to clutch the happiness so offered? How hideous a thing would be its enjoyment when deliberately accepted as the fruit of such bargain. So he's saying there in
explain
his dreadful,
all of what that means.
Hateful prose, I despise William James. William James, if you're listening, first of all, why? You're dead. Are you a zombie?
Not
two,
a fan of the
I
show.
Despise your prose. I would despise William James's prose.
Yeah, dial it back. Be more accessible, William James.
Basically, what he's saying is our instinct might be to say, oh yes, this situation is lovely. I'm going to grasp that happiness. I'm going to live it up. Mm-hmm. But he says
La vida loca.
The origin of that happiness taints the happiness.
Well, okay, so I think that's like the couple questions
if
that
you
I have
think
about
it.
This. Well, right. But, so maybe okay, but what I think is interesting in the Omalas is like, do the people have to go see this kid? Is it like a right that you go and see that, like RITE? Because like,
oh, is it like going to Mecca?
Right. Like, I feel like part of this is like, I think looking at that kid is going to bum you out and make that utopia a little bit less utopian. And also like, can you just not look at him? Because that's what That's what I would do.
Right.
I
so would not right. look. Here's what she says.
Just don't they all, look.
The,
just
they
don't
all
look.
Know it is there. All the people of Omelas. Some of them have come to see it. It being the child. Some of them have come to see it. Others are content merely to know it is there. They all know that it has to be there. Some of them understand why and some do not, but they all understand their happiness, the beauty of their city, the tenderness of their friendships, the health of their children, the wisdom of their scholars, the skill of their makers, even the abundance of their harvest and the kindly weathers of their skies depend wholly on this child's abominable misery. Children learn about this between the ages of 8 and 12. You are allowed to do something. You're allowed to come see the child. You're not like required to, but if you everyone does know about the child. Like, I kind of get the sense that you sort of have to know.
Yeah.
So I think part of the terms of this bargain that Le Guin is setting up is you can't ignore it. You can't not know. You can't live in blissful ignorance.
The details don't matter. It's almost pointless to ask questions about. I
think this one does matter.
Yeah, what if?
Because if you're able to,
Xbox?
If you're able to ignore it, then
it's just Xbox 2.
It's not a bargain anymore. If you're able to ignore it, like the negative, the cost is gone. The only cost of this is you have to know that there is a kid with sores on his butt from sitting in his own crap. A kid who is scared of the mops in the corner of the mop closet because he doesn't know what they are and they're always there. A kid who eats cornmeal and grease for his one meal a day. You can't not know that. And if you did not know that, the society would not exist as it does.
I mean, I think the obvious thing to say here is like, I mean, I don't know if this is meant, but I feel like we do kind of live in this system. Like, we do in the Western world live in kind of a frickin' utopia that is made possible by like the labor of third world countries, by your phone being assembled by companies that have suicide debts on the outside of their headquarters, right? Like we do benefit from the suffering of others. And it is something that we learn about when we're kind of young. Like the first time, like how old were you when you heard like Nike actually makes their clothes in sweatshops? And then you get older and you're like, oh, right. I think all clothes are made in sweatshops. Yeah. Like, I'm pretty sure that's how this goes.
I'm just hearing about this now.
Well, Nick, I have bad news for you about clothes and phones and technology and everything that you use. Is this allegory? Is this being like, hey, I'm showing you a mirror of the world that you live
She's
in?
Not.
Or is it?
Yeah. It's so she intends this. She writes this as a philosophical exercise, but I think, and she wrote this 50 years ago. This came out in 74, which is a long 73. It's a long time. The world was different back then. I think more and more our happiness is predicated on a variety, making peace with a variety of dreadful things about the world. And
we know more.
That's true. I mean, it could also be right. Like
just because of technology, we have,
like, we are more aware of,
you can live stream every war that's happening right now.
Right. Yeah. We're more aware of the kid in the hole than we have ever been. Maybe there's always been a kid in the hole. But now we know they're there. And the question, I think, so this gets to, and this is where we can kind of wrap up. The question of this is the end. Like, what do you do? So she puts forward two options. You know, and you stay there, or you know, and you leave. And those are kind of like, if knowing is not such a dreadful thing, if the benefit outweighs the cost of knowing, then you stay. And if the cost of knowing is too much, you walk away.
This is bullshit. This is bullshit. Here's my opinion.
What would you do? So, Nick, what would you do?
I didn't put the fucking kid in there. Now I have to make, this is on me now, just another person getting stepped on. Like, fuck you. I'd like to know who put that kid in there.
And
I'd like his name and his personal address.
So this is
all complaints get filed at the local office and those will be forwarded to the master and chief in charge.
There have been a variety of responses to this story because this story kind of sparked this firestorm.
I'm not the dictator, Ian.
Well, so it's not dictatorship. This is community based, but there's a really good, There's a modern, science fiction author named N.K. Jemisin, who has written a short story about the ones who stay and fight. Yeah. So people who stay there and they're like, okay, that's a third option. Maybe I don't walk away. Maybe I don't like ignore it. Maybe I do my best to come up with a better world.
Wait a minute.
Yes.
A new author wrote like a response to this premise.
Yes.
That's really cool.
Oh, it's so cool. Good. It gets better. So recently, last month, I saw a link on Twitter to a new short story published in Clark's World Scientific Magazine, sci-fi magazine. The title is "Why Don't We Just Kill the Kid in the Omelas Hole?" And it's
less catchy of a title.
I know, but it's set in the same. It's set in the same world, and it's a fourth option. So you stay, and you're fine with the bargain. You walk away. You stay and fight, try and overthrow the society, or you say the kindest thing to do to this child is to kill the child. Mm-hmm. And then what happens when the child is killed?
They find another one.
So what do you do with that kid?
You gotta kill all the kids, I think.
And so this, like, the story kind of puts forward, this is what they call accelerationism. Like, let's make this. The more kids get publicly put in the Omelas hole in her story, in the response, the more people start wondering, well, whose kid is it? Is this going to be my kid next? Am I okay with that? And every time a new kid has to be put in the Omelas hole, people have to re-reckon with the injustice of this, the apparent injustice of this. And so this is another option that says, let's push this system to its breaking point. At what time, at what stage will people give up on this trade-off?
Joseph, what book did you bring? Tell us what Karen said.
I brought a novelette recommended by Kara. I really like the word novelette. I've never heard it before. I was looking it up a little bit earlier, and pretty much it's just a novella, novella, as Ian likes to say.
I think it should be its own thing. The theme name.
Novelettes.
Dystopian novelettes. Yeah.
Novelettes. I don't exactly know why some people classify this as a novelette. It does come in three parts. I think it has kind of chapters to it. Okay. It's super short. The whole thing is like 30 pages long, but there's like three chapters to it. So
longer than Ian's. Point Ian. Yeah.
Karen, loyal lithead, says Reasons for Greatness. It's a short story follow-up to your dystopia episode. I think she might have submitted this quite a while ago.
Yes, this is one of the oldest. Karen, you're probably not listening anymore. You've probably gone on to bigger and better podcasts. But this is a recommendation from literally years ago.
Karen's waited nearly 150 episodes for this to finally come through.
Right. Like so many podcasts, we started during COVID, and she says, boy, this short story feels like crazy prescient. It's great because it's a vision of the futility of, quote, being alone together. It's about the futility of what it means to interact only virtually. It also makes me think about what will happen as we run out of work for people to do. Will hosting hobby seminars for online audiences be enough to keep people happy? And how suffocating does idleness become? Incredibly thoughtful recommendation. I really appreciated this. And the other thing she says is, you've probably already heard of this short story. I had not, Karen. I appreciate how much confidence you put in our encyclopedic knowledge of everything
I've heard of it, Karen. Don't worry.
I'd like to just add that we have scientific confirmation of the difference between a novelette and a novella. Mm,
thank you.
A novelette generally runs between 17,500 words. Mm-hmm. So it's that in that range there. Whereas a novella is between 17,500 and 40,000. So
this was short. I mean, this took me an hour to read. So there's a few things to talk about for this. I could talk about the plot. I could talk a little bit about the author. Nick, does E.M. Forrester, does that mean anything to you? Does that ring any bells?
Is that from Finding Forrester?
It is the Finding Forrester guy. And it's okay. You're the man now, this is what dog. I assumed your cultural connection would be to this. You the man now, dog. Yes, go ahead.
Please. Okay, please, I wish you would.
You're the man now, dog. That's pretty good.
That's really good.
It was really good. So I was really excited. E.M. Forrester, the novel, the movie Finding Forrester, is there's an author in that movie that kind of mentors a young man into becoming a writer. Yes. That author is ostensibly based on E.M. Forrester. So I went into this being like, oh, cool. I'm going to have all this E.M. Forrester stuff, right? Like he's going to be this famous recluse who lives in a Brooklyn apartment overlooking a basketball court. It turns out none of that is true. He is a little reclusive. He didn't write very much in his life. Like he published a handful of influential novels. He died in like 1970. This short story was written in 1909. So the connections are vague. He was a British guy. He was a little bit reclusive. He was a little bit surly. His interviews are kind of famously terse. He would give like one sentence answers to these questions from interviews.
He would say things like, "You're the man now, dog."
Yeah, "You're the man now, dog."
I wish. I don't know.
Ian? Did you want to try to do the voice?
No, I do not want to try and do the voice.
He does want to do it.
I wish the three of us were known for our terse delivery in interviews. I feel like to be known for your interviewing style is, that's pretty great.
Ian, if we're ever interviewed, I'm sure we'll all come off as total pricks. Don't worry about that one.
Oh, great. Oh yeah. Nice. Okay, cool. Yep. Cool.
So, Joe, that's a bit about the author.
Yeah.
Ultimately, he went on to be named after a Subaru vehicle as well, I'm reading here.
Important, not Forrester, Forster.
Oh,
okay. Forster.
Oh, then never.
Nope, no relation.
That article then, yeah. No
did he die at some point?
No, nope, he's still around.
Nope, but well, Subaru Foresters are still around, if that's what you're thinking of. Right? E.M. Forrester has passed on.
Mm-hmm. Joe, what is this book about?
All right. This book is on its surface, like so many classic dystopian novels, this book on its surface presents a pretty ideal society. Mm-hmm. This book comes in three parts. In part one, we are introduced to our main character. It's a woman living contentedly in her honeycomb apartment. All the kind of a cool image, like all people live in like kind of this beehive complex where you have a hexagonal apartment. Her son calls.
What?
It's a hexagonal. Hey, Nick, just move on. It's a hexagonal apartment. Just move on.
She lives in a beehive?
The room that you're in right now is a square rectangle rectangle of some sort. In the future, the underground rooms are hexagons, which of course is a superior thing to a rectangle.
Right, structurally, because they can be, sounder.
They're
more
very
ground,
strong. Yeah. Yes.
How focused dystopias are on the room, like the living quarters of the people. Yeah. I'm thinking of how much we learn about where people live in 1984. Mm-hmm. It's like, it's a huge thing.
Yeah. Or like, I think of Fahrenheit 451 too. Like when I think of that, like I think of the houses that they live in with like this, all the walls being TVs.
Yeah,
people are super into it. So we're introduced to this woman. She lives in this apartment. She lives in an apartment with a machine integrated into every aspect of it. So anything she wants, anything she wants is available with a flip of a switch, a touch of a button. This is written in 1909. So this is all mechanical switches. Like there's this big guy.
Steampunk,
yeah. There's a big guy that's like, oh, if you want your bed to come out, you flip these three switches, click, 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 and your bed comes out for the night. If you want a hot ham delivered to your house, you flip these two switches and push this button.
They got hot ham buttons. Their whole house is just buttons.
It's buttons and switches all the way down.
Yeah.
The machine is integrated into every part of your life, and it does everything for you. And it is just called the machine. Like these aren't separate components. If you want something, you ask the machine for it, and the machine, through a series of toggle switches and button pushes, is able to provide it almost without fail, right? Almost without fail.
And is it truly anything? Like it's just anything at your fingertips?
Yeah, it has like almost like Jean-Luc Picard replicator things. It's
this
like,
is
I
what
want
I'm
some
thinking
hot tea.
Of.
Yep.
This is the holodeck.
This is the holodeck.
So where does it come from?
Star Wars
fans.
It's
got to have raw material.
Yeah, like this it comes
quiet. We didn't ask about the different
mechanism. I'm sorry, but it's a novelette. He has more space to cover this. Okay,
that's true. There is some discussion of like the behind the scenes and the limitations of the machine. So, for example, we don't get into like, is this ethically sourced cotton that's making up your sheets, right? Instead, we get into like well, this happens behind the scene. This is a mechanical thing. So, like your bed is going to be the same bed that everybody else gets. If you wanted a bigger bed or a smaller bed, I'm sorry, that's not going to be possible because significant alterations would have to happen to the machine to make that happen.
So what's the conflict in the book, Joe?
Oh, I bet I know. Can I guess what it is?
Is it hot ham? The ham comes cold?
The ham gets too hot.
Yeah. No, that's not it.
People all over the country are in their hexagonal rooms are just burning their fingies and their tongues on the hot ham. And the ham, what's worse, the ham won't cool down.
The conflict is she gets a phone call. She gets like a holodeck phone call, right? Like from her son, a video pops up. By the way, once again, 1909, right? Like predicting a lot of technologies that we take for granted today. Yep. A video screen pops up. Her son is there. And her son lives on the other side of the world and says, "Hey, Mom, I have something to tell you, but I can't say it over the machine.
Oh, boy.
Can you come and see me?"
Perfect.
And this is like kind of a horror for this woman. Like she is inside. Like this is a world in which people have gotten so insulated from each other. The thought of like leaving this cell, like seeing other people on like the airships that shuttle you efficiently around the world is kind of grotesque. Like you don't touch other people. It's seen as like an incredible taboo to touch somebody else. Even the sight of the physical world, like the sight of the sun cresting over the charred earth or like the Himalayas in the distance, they have almost a repulsion to these things. So going across the world is a big deal.
So she can leave though, right? There's a poison gas above ground.
Yes, you can leave. The surface of the earth is, it's just not done. There are safe ways to travel around the world.
Of course.
The surface of the earth is like, it's kind of like the road rules where it seems like there's been some sort of apocalypse. We never get exactly what it is. Surface of the earth is charred. Doesn't matter. So you can travel out, but people generally don't because there's no need to.
So she's predicted 2024 work from home.
Yes.
Pretty
100%.
Well.
Yeah. 120 years ahead of time.
Yes. Amazing. So, okay. She obviously goes and meets the kid.
Yeah, so she goes to the other side of the world. She goes by airship. She walks into a honeycomb room that is identical to her own in every way, except her son is there. And he tells her how he has become unsatisfied and how he's begun to test the limits of his human capacity, test the limits of his underground world, and start to poke at the edges of it a little bit.
Oh, man. He's going to ruin it for everybody.
Yeah, it's not going to be good.
What's the problem then?
Well, the problem is that as he... This is the problem. The son in this book...
Never mind, I just got the whole point. Yeah. Got it. Okay, so we're losing our humanity.
You got it.
Technology is taking away our humanity. This is a commentary on the steam engine. Joe, is that correct?
Or, you know, like, I don't know, moving pictures, something like that. No, the sun in this world feels as if there is something that is limiting his humanity here, right? Yeah. Like, he even talks about things. There's kind of a revealing scene in here where he says, "We use words like near and far, but I had no physical understanding of what near and far meant. So I went up to the train station and I walked back and forth on the platform. I walked back and forth the length of the platform all day until I almost could not walk anymore. And I understood. I understood that things that are near are things that you can get to quickly on your feet. Things that are far are things that you cannot get to quickly on your feet. And for the first time in my life, I had like an in my bones understanding of what it means for something to be far.
Is it worth it, though?
Walking on the platform like that, yeah. Or climbing, or poking at the edges.
Having that information.
Well, the argument in this book is very much like it is worth it, right? Mm. That when we surrender huge parts of our life to the machine for comfort or convenience or whatever it is, that we lose something about being human in our life.
Does he become Superman? Is this where Superman comes from?
Right. Is this Harrison Bergeron? Like, is this, and then I jumped higher and higher and threw the ballerina into the air.
Oh, that's fun.
She gets a call from the kid and he says, "Mom, the machine stops." Like, the machine is breaking down, right? And then things start to go a little bit wrong in their world. Like, all of a sudden the ham is a little too hot and the music is a little too discordant. And the machine that they have relied on for years and like for generations begins to break.
Is it a punishment because this chump was climbing and climbing? Is he to blame? Should we put him in a hole?
What about his wings of wax, Joe?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Perhaps.
These are all very good questions.
Thank you.
One of them is a little more prescient than the other ones.
Thank you, Joe. Is it about the wax?
Yeah. Yes, it's Nick. Congratulations. It's the wings of wax. You got
no. Suck it. This is secretly a game, and you won, Nick. Look at that.
Remember, hostility, Ian. Go to hell.
In this novelette, the machine becomes so central, so ubiquitous in all of their lives that it becomes an almost deity. Like in the first generation, like the machine was built by people. It was built by brilliant engineers who understood how it all worked and who like built it out of necessity. In the second generation, as those people died, all these individuals, like all these like sub-lieutenants become responsible for understanding some segment of the machine. Oh, I know how the replicators work. I know how the airship calling works. I know that. And then in the third generation, like the knowledge of how the machine works is kind of lost or diffused to the point where like it's no longer nobody understands how the machine works in a useful enough way to fix things as they go
it's
wrong.
It's like a company. It gets so big, nobody knows who's in charge.
So as the machine starts to break, like people do, like the machine somewhere along this way has become deified, right? Like, and people think that when their tea is a little too hot, that they're being kind of punished by the machine for something that they did wrong. Well,
I think you mean if their ham is too hot.
Or the ham is too hot, tea is too cold. I'm sorry. Yes, the machine breaks in very specific ways.
Too hot to handle, too cold to hold.
Is that just spoiling everything? You spoil everything right there?
Well, I think like Ian's book, like my book is definitely longer. My novelette is definitely longer than Ian's wimpy 5-page story.
Interesting.
But I think like the what happens in here isn't as interesting as like the ideas that it makes you think about. Like this is the genre, right? Like this is dystopia. Like what if the world were X? And I think one of the wild things about this book is you start to see the parallels with the world that we do live in today, 110 years later, or whatever it is, 115 years later. Like, yes, there's the live at home stuff. Yes, there's the work from home, the video conferencing, the Skyping, the all of that stuff. But also, like, there's this incredible reliance on systems that no individual understands.
Oh, what's the Clark quote about any science sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic? Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And like for us, like we all kind of take it in good faith. Like, well, we know how the internet works. We know how networking works. We understand how this works. Or at least somebody does, right? We do not. And one of the interesting things that this book does is it comes to you in those three parts. And in part one, it's kind of a utopia. In part two, it's kind of a dystopia. And in part three, it kind of turns into a horror book, right? Like as this machine kind of stops.
Yeah. Like all good sci-fi, right? Yeah. It's got to end in horror.
So there's a lot of moving pieces to this novelette. It was pretty dang interesting to read. I had never read it before. I'm awfully glad I did. Thank you, Kara.
Gentlemen, welcome to Tiffany's, a safe place for you to tell me all the terrible, terrible, terrible things about your book. Joseph, tell me a bit about what you hated about the book. What was it actually good?
It was good, like a lot of, like...
Great.
Like a lot of dystopian things, I don't think the story, like what happened in the story, was actually all that interesting. I think the ideas that it presented are ideas that I really enjoyed chewing on my walk last night. Yeah. So yeah, the ideas were great. The story was fine. Yes.
Ruminating. Joe ate his book. Ian.
Nom, 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 nom.
I wanted more than just two solutions. I think she's too simplistic. It's stay or go. Should I stay or should I go now? And the subsequent stories do a nice job of adding to this. Like maybe you stay and fight. Maybe you accelerate. But her story is like binary. It's black and white. And I think this is more complicated than that. So Ursula K. Le Guin, your literature is too simple.
These both sound pretty good. Joe, you lose. I'm just so drawn to the premise of Ian's book here. I think it sounds...
That kid in a hole.
A kid in a hole.
All right. Well, Ian, congratulations. Ursula K. Le Guin, we always enjoy having you on the show. We appreciate it.
And she comes, she conquers.
She comes, she sees, she conquers. And Karen, I'm very sorry I let you down. Get
Once
in
again.
Line of the many recommendations who have not won this show. I guarantee more have lost than have won. And I think by a significant margin.
The book sounds excellent. It was Joe right. that's lost
It was
today.
Me
it's
that
Joe
lost.
Joe lost so, today, yes. not the book. Yes.
All right. Litheads, you know what to do. We are on social media, primarily TikTok, I think. That used to be a joke when we started saying it, but
TikTok.
Now it's absolutely true. We are exclusively yep, on TikTok. So you can head on over there and follow us and swipe us and double tap us and, you know, engage.
Get engaged to us.
You can suggest a book, you can suggest a theme, you can request a sticky over there. Congratulations, Ian. Congratulations, Ursula K. Le Guin. I am so sorry, Karen. See you next week.
All right, I'm going to read, because the story is so short, I'm going to read the whole thing. I'm going to read, Le Guin has got a real way with words when she talks about her own work, and I love that she does that. A lot of authors are just like, yeah, here's my work, deal with it. Le Guin is like, I will tell you what some thoughts I have about the work are. So this is what she has to say about Omelas many years after she published it. She republished it in a self-edited collection. And this is her blurb on this short story. Omelas, which is pronounced Omelas. She spells it out for you. Omelas is a fable, I think. Its premise was stolen from the philosopher William James. You can also find it in Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov being told by the Grand Inquisitor with a somewhat different purpose. My version of it has had a long and happy career of being used by teachers to upset students and make them argue fiercely about morality. Thank you.